We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Dua and Mason Ginsburg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time.
Welcome to In the Know. We're joined by Ryan Bernadoni. He's a esteemed writer of the Celtics. He covers the Celtics. He's not a writer of the Celtics. He is an amazing follow on Twitter. He is one of the most knowledgeable cat people I know on the line. Ryan, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I think this is where I apologize to your listeners for my cold. But other than that, doing good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Hey, man. We're glad to have you on. And just a little bit of a background on Ryan. Ryan and I have interacted for years on Reddit and on Twitter. And basically, the interactions have gone like this. Ryan will tweet something super insightful about the Celtics preparing to make a move for Anthony Davis sometimes in the future. So whether it's like, you know, signing Marcus Smart to the contract he signed on, or just speculating about, you know, how the Celtics can go about acquiring it, and me jumping in his mentions, calling him an idiot, saying Davis isn't going to leave, and, you know, Ryan being very patient with that. So turns out that Ryan has been onto something the whole time, and the Celtics are in a really good position now that Anthony Davis has requested a trade. Ryan, I wanted to start this podcast off. The last few weeks have just been an absolute mess for anyone following the Pelicans. What was your first reaction when you saw the initial Woj tweet that Davis wants out, or he no longer wants to be part of New Orleans and he has requested a trade?
Well, from a Celtics perspective, I think everybody understood that that wasn't like the ideal scenario for Boston. Because obviously the Celtics, as I'm sure everybody listening to this knows, can't trade for him or couldn't trade for him at the trade deadline. So, you know, from that perspective, it's not what you were looking for. But it wasn't a surprise, particularly. I think most people believe that if it were to happen, it was going to happen in the offseason, because Davis, from an outsider perspective, like, I don't, you know, follow the Pelicans closely enough to have a great insight into his personality. But he didn't seem like somebody who was going to take that drastic of a step and sort of burn the bridges in the way that he has. But obviously that was incorrect. And for whatever reason, he decided to go that direction, or, you know, the team that he's working with decided to lead him in that direction. I don't really know. So when that first came out, it was a little bit of like, okay, well, this is what the Celtics have been preparing for. It's also what I think a couple other teams have been preparing for, but not the ideal way for it to go. Sort of interesting fallout of that, right, is like you said, we've been interacting for a while, and the Lakers ham-handedness and all of this has sort of seemingly turned the Celtics into like an ally instead of the enemy, which is kind of a weird position, because obviously, you know, Ainge and the Celtics have been planning for a while to try to trade for your best player. We would naturally be a team that you would not like very much at all under those circumstances, but it's just been such a, you know, such a poorly handled situation that it now seems like a decent number of Pelicans fans are like, well, you know, better the Celtics if the Celtics obviously make the best offer than to see him end up with the Lakers, or, you know, that's probably the one, right? The Lakers is where people don't want to see him land at this time. So it's been kind of a weird situation. But that's basically what my thought was when it happened, was, okay, not a big surprise, but also from a Celtics perspective, not exactly what we were looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. And was there a part of you that was sweating the Lakers succeeding in their endeavors? Like, while all that nonsense was going on and you were watching it unfold, is there a moment you're like, you know what, the Lakers might actually get Davis?
Not particularly, to be honest. It just doesn't make, it just never made sense, right? If the argument for them getting him at that time wasn't that they were in the best position to do it or making the best offer, it was basically that the Pelicans would get so frustrated with the situation that they would just throw their hands up and make sort of a, you know, a rash move to trade him for whatever they could get at that moment. But like, just because it seems like that, whatever, 2 weeks were like a long time on Twitter, it was like 2 weeks. They had to wait out a couple of weeks. And basically what is waiting that out really mean? It means just not trading him, right? Like, there was no real impetus to make it happen. So I never particularly thought that it was going to happen. Also, you sort of, you know, a lot of the stuff, if you pay close enough attention, you can tell where a lot of the leaks are coming from, and sort of what they probably mean behind the scenes. And, like, there wasn't any moment where you're like, oh, boy, this is going to happen, you know, right now. So it always seemed unlikely. I think that, from a Celtics perspective, the bigger issue that has arisen is that he seems legitimately set on wanting to go to the Lakers, right? Like, even now where he's doing like, oh, he's doing a television show with LeBron at the All-Star break and stuff like that, where it might legitimately raise a question for the Celtics of like, is he really going to only play for 1 year and then leave? Like, if he's really that committed to going there, which could potentially be a problem, not just for the Celtics, but for other teams. So I think that like that has maybe raised some eyebrows, but the actual like immediacy after the Woj tweet up until the trade deadline, I mean, you are on social media. Mostly what it was team, like, fans of all of the other teams making fun of the Lakers for what was kind of a ridiculous set of circumstances. And I was kind of in that. Like, I just didn't feel like it was imminently going to happen at that time. So we'll see. We'll see in the summer. But yeah, I didn't think it would happen at the trade deadline.
It's funny that you mentioned the 2 weeks kind of dragging on, because I remember this interaction between us pretty vividly, and you're like, man, this is going to be an exhausting 2 weeks, isn't it? And I was like, oh yeah, you think it's going to be exhausting? Imagine being us. So funny how that all kind of played out. You know, one of the things that Davis's father has mentioned about the Celtics is, you know, how they treated Isaiah Thomas, and he's using that as an excuse to, you know, say that we're not going to send Davis there. And you sort of mentioned Davis kind of having his mindset going to the Lakers. When that tweet or that report came out, what were your thoughts on that? Did you find it as ridiculous as we found it?
Yeah, I mean, I think my like reaction tweet was basically like the story of the Lakers trading Lamar Odom, right? Like, Lamar Odom won titles with the Lakers. He was a big part of their franchise for a relatively decent number of years, longer than Isaiah was with the Celtics. And they tried to trade him and eventually did trade him. And he basically like blamed it for ruining his life. And that's not to say that the Lakers did anything wrong. It's just that every team has trades where they trade a player who feels like something didn't go the way they wanted it to, because like that's what trades are, right? You sign somewhere and then they trade you, and it's not your choice in the vast majority of circumstances. It's also a little bit funny because like Isaiah clearly had hurt feelings toward the Celtics for a while, but like there's like a legitimate love affair between the Celtics fans and Isaiah, which I think will be pretty clear when the Nuggets come to Boston in a couple of weeks. So, you know, it is what it is. Again, you can read the tea leaves on some of that thing, some of those things, and like they were trying to force their way to a particular situation, and the way that they thought that they had to do that was to poison the well for every other team, and that was just part of that campaign to do that. And again, maybe it will work. Like, it might get to the summer and all of this will continue on, and that other teams will really buy into the idea that the Lakers are going to keep this cap space open for an entire year, and they're going to sort of burn a season of LeBron, or they'll sign a bunch of one-year contracts and whatever, and that he's just going to walk and he's going to go there because he so desperately wants to play with 36-year-old LeBron James and nobody else, because he just wants to be in Los Angeles for whatever reason with, you know, a front office, an ownership group, a coach, like no proven commodities and any of that. So it seems like a weird career decision, but maybe people eventually buy into it. You know, I can't say for sure one way or another, but I think that was sort of more the story again out of that specific thing. It was like, have you legitimately poisoned the well where teams will walk away even in the summer, or was it all just like posturing and everybody will get over it?
So I have a question kind of as it relates to this entire AD situation, and it's in your eyes, what's the role that Kyrie has played in all of this? And so we don't have to get into the, you know, is he staying or is he going conversation, but what I am interested to know what the relationship there is, in your opinion, between that, him staying or him going, versus the Celtics trying to trade for AD. Like if Kyrie for whatever reason says I'm going and, you know, I'm out of here, I'm going to New York, and you know, before AD, you know, that before the summer comes up, will the Celtics still, you know, really go all in for Anthony Davis? Just what's your general sense on the current Kyrie Irving situation and how it plays into the AD chase?
And do you think that part of poisoning the well, you know, Rich Paul and Davis and his camp, you know, were releasing the reports about Kyrie maybe not wanting to stay around Boston, and were they the ones propagating those rumors?
Don't lead the witness, man.
Yeah, well, second part first. I think that that's... So Kyrie has sort of given a couple of weird interviews in Boston that I don't know how, you know, I don't know how closely Pelicans fans have been watching them, but they went, you know, sort of made national basketball news. And it was pretty clear that in at least one of those, that's sort of what he was saying, was that he's tired of being used as a pawn in other people's games. And that's seemingly pointing towards that idea, right? That Clutch and people around Davis or around the Lakers are sort of putting out rumors about him, and he didn't really appreciate that, and he doesn't like having to talk to the media about all this stuff all the time, and it's sort of just wearing on him. So, you know, how that sort of has played out. He's also just kind of a, you know, he's kind of a weird person, right? Like, he says a lot of strange things. He has a personality that maybe isn't made for, you know, having a spotlight on him all the time like it is. I imagine it does legitimately wear on him. Going to New York or anywhere else, that's not going to change, and I'm sure he knows that. So I don't think it's like he's being like chased out of Boston or anything like that by the situation, because it's going to follow him no matter where he goes. But I do think that he doesn't necessarily like enjoy sitting in press conferences while people ask him about, you know, contracts and everything all the time. Does somebody else want to jump in there? I can answer the other question.
No, I was going to make a snide Bill Simmons comment, but I started
to hold back. All right, well, yeah. noted Clippers fan Bill Simmons. So to the other part, like a big part of, and I think that the team sort of behind the scenes has been relatively open about this, is that a big part of the reason they went and got Kyrie wasn't because that they believe that that he is one of the 3, 4, 5 best players in the league that you need to win a title. I think that he's been exceptional this season, and that he's been probably a top 10 player this year, and probably better than anybody really thought that he was necessarily going to be, even though it is sort of his prime age years right now. But the reason that they went out and got him, it seems, was because he's a Team USA guy who is very, very popular amongst other you know, elite players in the NBA. For whatever reason, his personality that doesn't get along great with, like, the media, he's really well-liked by other big-name players. You know, he and Kevin Durant are, like, I don't know if they're best friends outside of basketball, but, like, within basketball, they seem to be, like, best friends. To the point where when they had that weird video of, you know, that somebody took in the back hallway, and he came out afterwards, he was like, I was talking to my best friend. Like, that's all it was. I wasn't, like, scheming on moving to New York with him. Like, we were just shooting the shit in the hallway before the All-Star game because he's my best friend. And by all accounts, he's friends, or at least friendly, with Davis and with a lot of other elite players in the league. And so part of the reason that they went out and got him seems to be because they thought that he would be an attraction to other players to come to Boston, and more importantly than that, for them all to then stay in Boston. So he's a big part of that, you know, that pitch to get Davis. If he weren't with the team, I don't think that they would go truly all in for Davis at that point, because if all the signals you're getting are that he legitimately, like, would prefer to be in Los Angeles and you don't have Irving, then you're not going to win a title if you trade everything for Davis and you don't have Kyrie in, like, the one-year window that you may have opened up. If you do have Kyrie, then you might win that title, even in just that 1 year. Like, even if it's literally a one-year commitment, I think that they would push very, very, very hard for that. The other thing that comes up is that the trade conversation is going to happen at the draft, right? It's going to happen a week before the draft, 2 weeks before the draft. Like, that's when it's going to happen, sometime between the lottery and the draft, basically. And that being the case, like, they'll be moving in part to convince Kyrie if there's any question about him staying. So, you know, it would be difficult to imagine them walking away at that time when the trade is most likely to happen anyway, unless, you know, the season ends, they lose in the second round or something, and Kyrie just throws up his hands and, like, tells the world that he's leaving, although he told the world that he was staying, so who really knows. But, you know, to the question of if he did, like, actively say that he was leaving, or that it dragged on into July and he just did leave, it would be hard for the Celtics to give up everything for Davis for that, you know, for the obvious reason that then, no offense, but then you're the Pelicans, and then he's going to leave. So,
so before we get into, you know, the kind of specifics of what a potential Davis trade might look like, we kind of touched upon this on earlier in the podcast, how the Celtics have long been preparing for this day, right? Can you touch upon how they have, you know, the steps they have taken to ensure that they're in a good spot to make this trade, and you know, what are some of the things that weren't obvious on the surface level but were clearly, you know, done in mind with Davis entering the market?
Sure. I mean, I can try to lay out some of that. So some of that is just big picture philosophical stuff, right? And again, the Celtics are not, like, cloak and dagger about this stuff. Ainge says on a regular basis when people ask him, not everybody listens to it because they want to come up with their own theories on how things go, but, like, the Celtics understand, just like everybody else does, the history of the NBA, that if you want to win a title, you have to have, like, an MVP, right? You have to have somebody who has won an MVP already, almost universally, unless you're the Pistons. And Ainge says that, like, he said multiple times, like, we aren't talented enough to win the title throughout different parts of his tenure with the Celtics. And that's led to multiple chases for elite players. So the two most notable ones to this point are Kevin Garnett, that worked, right? They were able to maneuver through that process and get Garnett. And then, after the Nets trade and the sort of pivot towards relevance with the Isaiah Thomas trade, the Isaiah trade was part of a maneuver that you could see at the time to get Durant, right? So that was, Durant has always been, like, Ainge's favorite. It might still be in some way, but that was their target at that point. So when they signed Al Horford, they had built a team sort of projecting out the cap spike and all this other stuff, where the entire point of that offseason was to say, look, we can sign two max players, right? So we have a pitch here that's not come to join this 40-something win team. It's come to join this team that has, like, a perfect set of role players, and we're signing two max players, which throughout recent NBA history has been much more attractive than signing a single one. And so that doesn't work. Fine. And then you have to sort of set up the next one. And you can look out into the league, and there's only a handful of guys who, like, qualify for this level of planning, right? And so that's why, for a couple of years, we've been saying, like, okay, well, Davis is the next one. You can look at the CBA provisions. You can say what's going to happen is that either the Pelicans are going to be good enough to keep him by offering him the Supermax, or not good enough, he'll decline the Supermax. There's then no contract advantage going forward. They're going to trade him this coming summer. And you can plan out, you know, far enough in advance where the team could start putting in, you know, putting in place those pieces. Now, I don't think they've actually had to do a ton of stuff that was like specifically designed for that. The big one, obviously, is like I said, they traded for Kyrie. Now, you can make an argument they would have traded for Kyrie anyway. You look back and you say, like, oh, that's a heist, right? Colin Sexton and Ante Zizic and Jay Crowder and whatever. But, like...
Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah, well, but Isaiah, we knew... Or I didn't know that Isaiah was as hurt as he was, right? But obviously the team knew that he was significantly injured. And so they were treating him... And there were reports of this afterwards, basically, where both teams were treating him after they saw his medical as, like, salary cap filler. So when I saw the trade, I was like... Boy, that doesn't make any sense. Isaiah just had one of the great offensive seasons of all time. And we're also giving up this draft pick. And, like, Kyrie is, you know, is really, really good, but he's not that good. And then when you learn that Isaiah was, you know, that his health situation was as bad as it has proven to be, that was a different deal. But even that draft pick, like, going into the lottery, that pick still had a, you know, 10 or 15% chance, I can't remember, of being, you know, of being Doncic. Like, that could have been a real big deal. So that move, though, like I said, was part of setting up the idea of trying to attract not just being able to get somebody like Davis, but then also being able to retain him. But there are other things that happen, right? They had all these draft picks, and they made them, right? They made moves to roll some picks forward, but I don't think any of them were, like, specifically Davis-related, necessarily. The Memphis pick they have, you know, was from trading Jeff Green, like, a long time ago, and... The Clippers pick they picked up is, you know, a lot of these things kind of go back years.
And trade with the Pelicans, weirdly enough.
That involved the Pelicans, right? Yeah. It became a three-team trade that rolled them in, right?
Yep.
But also a pick that was originally for Jeff Green, because all picks are related to Jeff Green somehow. Literally all picks. Everybody this draft, all 30 picks, first round, all have been traded for Jeff Green at some point in the past by law. So they haven't really done anything particularly special. Now, the two things that come up from contract perspectives are, one, why did they pick up Gershon Yabusele's contract option for next year? It seems kind of irrational. Even he never plays for them now. He's sort of a lovable figure, but he never plays. And so even if they wanted to retain him next year, he's not going to get more than his option. You know, you could re-sign him for the minimum. So why did they pick it up? Probably because they're looking for salary fodder in case they have to build up money for Davis or for Davis and Solomon Hill or something like that. And then re-signing Marcus Smart, which is actually doesn't appear to have anything to do with that either necessarily. The contract they gave him was pretty fair market at the time. It's an ascending annual value, so it's not like a descending one where they juice the first couple of years for trade purposes. Now he's, I think, a significant player asset anyway on that contract, so it's not like that was done specifically for that. So I don't think they've been doing, like, individual moves specifically to get Davis. It's more just like a relatively predictable path forward for a team that's kind of always looking for this kind of move and this kind of player. So long answer to tell you that they picked up Yabusele's option.
I mean, it was a great answer.
Yeah. I mean, it's the perfect level of detail, especially because, you know, even though there are plenty of hardcore NBA Pelicans fans listening to this podcast, very few probably know that kind of detail about the Celtics. And so kind of on that note, thinking about what the trade might look like. I mean, I know we've all kind of had conversations about, you know, hey, there's one side of this that says Danny Ainge always plays hardball and he never, you know, he always gets a pretty good deal. And the other side of this says Anthony Davis is Anthony Davis and he'll give up whatever to get that type of player. So let's just, for the sake of argument, let's just say Tatum is in the deal. I'm curious what else you think goes into that deal. How is it structured? Whether it's Anthony Davis or AD and Hill, I personally, and we've talked about this, I don't give a shit if Solomon Hill is in this trade, because it's all about the assets you're getting back. And there's one more year of Hill's deal. I don't care if you eat that. So what do you think the trade looks like?
So there's, you can, like, make a whole lot of sort of fanciful constructions for it. If you ask Celtics fans, some who do understand the salary cap rules and some who don't, you'll get a lot of, oh, they're going to sign and trade Terry Rozier, right? Like, there's this sort of idea that Rozier is going to be some key part. But he's what's called a base year compensation player if he gets part of a sign and trade, where basically whatever he signs for only counts for half of the outgoing salary amount. So if they sign him for, say, $15 million in his first year, it would only count for $7.5 million outgoing for the Celtics. It would cost $15 million incoming for for whoever is picking him up. If that's the Pelicans, that becomes difficult math. If it's a third team, maybe you can roll it in somehow. Like, the Celtics do have a legitimately very creative front office, but I'm just sort of laying out some of the ones that seem less likely. So including Rozier in any kind of sign and trade is complicated. If he was going to the Pelicans, he'd have a ton of leverage. Like, it just seems, you know, it's feasible, but you kind of want to set that one aside as, like, maybe not so much there. You can also get there without including, like, any really super high-level assets, especially if Aaron Baines picks up his option and you can, like, sign somebody to the mid-level for the remainder of this year and add some salary and Yabusele and blah, blah, blah. You can, like, make the math work, although it gets pretty hard, especially if Davis isn't going to waive his trade bonus to go to the Celtics. So what you're left with is three sort of obvious constructions of what you would have left. And they kind of go in tiers. So the first one is that you can include Marcus Smart, right, who makes about $12 million. Tatum makes $7 million. So you're up to $19 million. You have to get to like 25-ish if he doesn't, or sorry, 23-something, right, if he doesn't waive his trade bonus. So, you know, you add a couple players from there. Robert Williams, you can get in. Yabusele, like I said, they picked up his option seemingly like specifically for this purpose. And if you do that, you have Tatum and Smart and Williams are like three legitimate pieces for the long term. And then a bunch of draft picks, right? So like all the draft picks. It depends. We'll have to see where the Kings pick falls. And if the Clippers make the playoffs, then the Celtics get their pick this year. If not, rolls into next year. And it doesn't matter. Like, it's sort of a mid-value pick, possibly. The Memphis pick in the future that could turn out to be really, really good with them rebuilding now, although you never quite know for a pick that might be, you know, 2 years out at the very, you know, 1 or 2 years out. So you have that construction. Tatum, Smart, some salary filler picks. And then the other ways you can do it are Tatum and then one of the two big contracts, which would be Horford or Gordon Hayward. Now, personally, I don't really see why the Pelicans would want either of those players for where they are now. Horford is complicated, but he would also have to opt in. And so would he opt in and then get traded to the Pelicans while they're rebuilding? That, again, doesn't seem like super likely that he would want to do that. So you can think of a couple ways. One is Horford could opt in as part of a trade where he's going to a third team. The one I throw out is sort of a, you know, the one to be an example. Like, what if he went to Detroit and then Drummond went to the Pelicans? And, like, I'm not a big Andre Drummond fan, but you know, you could sell it, right? Two-time All-Star Andre Drummond plus Jason Tatum and draft picks and whatever. You know, you can sort of build a construction on Horford. And then the other one, again, is Hayward, who is starting to look better. He isn't playing tonight because he twisted his ankle in practice, but it wasn't his, the ankle that he broke. He has started to look better. If he looks really, like, significantly better over the next 25 games and into the playoffs and he starts to look like an asset again, maybe there's a third team trade that's in there. But really, the one that seems the most obvious to everybody is Tatum, Smart, salary filler, draft picks. So, you know, I would imagine things start there. It would break my heart because Marcus Smart's my favorite player and every Pelicans fan would love him, but that's the cost of doing business.
Oh yeah, every Pelicans fan is like salivating at the idea of putting Drew and Marcus together on a backcourt and just letting them wreak havoc on the opponent playing defense.
Well, Tatum's a really good defender, too. I don't think people realize, like, even though, you know, he's 20 years old, he's sort of seen as this, you know, scoring wing, but he's more in the sort of, like, Robert Covington mold, where he's, like, a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. You know, he's not Paul George on-ball defender like that level or Jimmy Butler, but he's actually a really good defender for a 20-year-old. And if you put, you know, Holiday and Smart and Tatum on the floor together, you are going to have a really good modern defense where, you know, so much of offense is created by the backcourt now. If you can put the, you know, defenders like that on the floor, you're not going to be a bad team. Like, you wouldn't be able to tank with that team. You'd be a team that would, if you were in the East, like, you would almost be guaranteed to make the playoffs. But Smart's also, like, a super fun player to watch, and everybody loves him.
Rooting against him, and then you're like, man, this guy.
Well, every Celtics fan
loves annoying player to watch because he makes threes at the most inconvenient moment.
Well, now he makes threes on a regular basis. Somehow, he's like a 37% 3-point shooter. All of a sudden, I don't know if it'll last, but
That team would be an Anthony Davis away from being a top three defensive team in the NBA.
That's what the Celtics' problem. Although we are, the Celtics are the fifth or fourth ranked defense. So I guess we have an Al Horford, so that gets you close.
So what if the Pelicans are and Davis are playing the long game, where they're just setting themselves up to be a perfect team for Davis to to play on, and then Davis leaves in free agency, and the Pelicans have max room the following year, and all of a sudden you got Drew Davis and Tatum and Smart, and you have a championship. Is that that's how it works, right?
Yeah, no, I mean that could very well be the case. They could all turn around real quick. I don't know if the math works on that exactly. But
I think you're firing clutch.
So it's like Darren Morey, right? Like we make our own math, make new math.
Yeah, absolutely. You in a forced sign in trade back to New Orleans. I was going to say stranger things happen, but maybe stranger things haven't happened enough. But there have been a lot of strange things that have happened in the last decade in the NBA. So who's to rule it out?
In the last 2 weeks, including,
that's true. Yeah.
Including, I mean, this probably is not that strange, but Dell Demps was let go as the New Orleans general manager, and one of the names that has sort of come across in local circles, and I think even in Woj tweeted about this, is Mike Zarin as a potential candidate. Now, Mike Zarin was he offered the Philly job outright, or he was considered for it, he flirted with it, and he was like, no, I don't really want this. But in any case, the word from Celtics fans that he's a Celtics diehard, he bleeds green. There's a wink-wink agreement with him and Danny Ainge to take over the Celtics when Ainge retires. And the odds of him coming to New Orleans are slim to none. First, do you agree with that idea that the odds of him leaving the Celtics are slim? And two, what sort of things do you think he brings to the table as a GM?
So it's hard for me to read anybody else's mind, right? So all we can go on is at least recent history. And I don't think the Sixers job is necessarily the first one that I don't know if he was formally offered it, like you said, but that he was in the running for. There have been other jobs that he's been rumored for in recent years, which makes sense. In my opinion, he's the best non-general manager, like non-existing general manager that any team could get. Some people would take umbrage with that and say, David Griffin won an NBA title and Sam Hinkie, whatever, in Philadelphia. I think Zarin is legitimately would be the best GM hire that any team could make, short of going and getting, stealing Hinkie, or not stealing Hinkie, stealing Morey, somebody like that. So, but the reality is, he seems to have been offered jobs in the past, and he legitimately has been a Celtics fan for his entire life. His dad was a season ticket holder. He goes to every Celtics home game and sits with his dad wearing his lucky Celtics warm-up jacket and rooting for the team like a fan. So there's a certain quality of life component to it that is just really hard for any of us to measure as an outside observer. He seems to really love the Celtics, and whether or not it's his dream job to be the Celtics GM and that there is some sort of handshake agreement where he will someday have it in the future, and so just waiting it out is the right thing to do. It could be that. It could also legitimately be that, if you're second in charge, you make a lot of money without a lot of, without all the same pressures. And so maybe he just likes his current job, and he likes that that he sits next to his dad at all the games and all that. So it doesn't seem like he has any inclination to leave the Celtics. That being said, if he wants to leave the Celtics, then personally, I would wish him well and hope that he gets whatever job he wants. I don't know him personally, although I've said hi to him before and talked to him a couple times when I'm at the game. He seems like a very nice person, but it's not really that. He's just given really good service to my team, and if he wants to go off and become a GM somewhere, then that would, I wish him well in that. I personally don't think that the Pelican situation is the one that he would necessarily be looking for, considering that he seems to have turned down offers for positions that seem like they would have been a little bit easier to handle in terms of talent and other situations. So, I don't think it's super, super likely, but I can't really say for sure. In terms of what he brings to the team, the reason I think that he would be a better candidate than even, somebody like Griffin is that he's been part of a team that's kind of gone through everything and navigated all of it well. They went through a brief kind of rebuilding, are we going to tank period for basically 1 year. They made really smart trades. They've gone after max level free agents. They've signed intelligent mid-range free agents. They've navigated the salary cap really well. So he's been part of a team that's done all that. The other thing is that he just plays a lot of roles. So he's the team's lead counsel. He's a lawyer. And that was his kind of first big role with the team, is that he was just doing the legal stuff. He's also one of the best salary cap guys in the entire league. And that sort of makes sense. You think of the salary cap as being like a math problem, but it's a legal document, right?
Like,
you have to understand
to
all
you,
the ins and outs.
Or like,
I think he's a little ahead of me. Although the reason that I've said hi to him is that like the salary cap tools that I built somehow caught his eye at one point, and he was like, "Oh, hey, nice to meet." Like, he knew my name because he knows everybody. The Celtics front office pays really close attention to like the national media, the specific team media. Like, they're very engaged with people.
Oh, they pay close attention to us too.
They pay attention
to
everybody.
But they reached out.
Yeah, they pay attention to a lot of things that are going on. As I think I've said to you, like, it's not like the game only lasts a couple hours during the day. They got to fill the rest of the time, right? So, but he was legal counsel. He's salary cap guru. He's done plenty of scouting, college scouting, pro scouting. He's, you know, right-hand man to one of the best GMs in the league already. So that's really what it comes down to, is that he just sort of has a full view of what the job of a GM is and across the league, and he can do a whole lot of different things and wear different hats. And I think as being part of the Celtics, he's probably, and there's no way to prove this, but he's probably also learned the value of, like, delegating. The Celtics have a really good front office that has four guys in it who all legitimately could be GMs at some point. Ainge, who obviously is a GM, Zarin, who could be and could have had jobs in the past, and Dave Lewin, who's their chief scout, was the Cavaliers salary cap guy. He could very well be a GM at some point. And Austin Ainge, who's Danny's son, is their head of international scouting. But again, with his sort of, you know, some of it's like pedigree stuff, right? It's nepotism. But he could be a GM at some point in the future, as well. He's another really smart. Exactly, right? And Austin Ainge is legitimately like a good basketball mind and a really smart guy. But they could have four people from their current front office who could all be GMs. And so the value of team, you know, having a leadership team and delegating, and but also how you have to have one decision maker and how you work with ownership and all that kind of thing. Like, he's just a very sharp guy who has a lot of skills in terms of what would make for, you know, a really high level general manager in the future. So what I've always said is, if he wants to leave the Celtics, I hope he gets whatever job he wants. I hope he doesn't want to leave the Celtics because he's been a huge asset to the team. So that's kind of, yeah, I don't know. Again, the long answer on, you know, who I see Mike Zarin being.
Yeah, it's really interesting, that conversation, because I feel like you hear a lot around the league about job being either a good GM job or a bad GM job, and it's often correlated to how good the team is. And I just that's just maybe outsider perspective, but I feel like that's kind of, that can be kind of garbage, because I feel like if I was a, you know, maybe a potential GM candidate, I would want a team maybe that isn't that good, but has the tools to be good and has an ownership situation that really will give me the keys and give me whatever resources necessary to turn the ship around. And I feel like that's kind of the ideal situation. And I'm not saying the Pelican situation is that. We don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of turmoil with the team over the past year or so. But I feel like a lot of people will often just look at how good the team's been historically and say whether it's a good situation or not based on that. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. So it seems like the answer to this question is probably going to be sort of an I don't know. But do you have any sense on if he was going to eventually look for a job outside of Boston, if he wanted to go get a GM job before Danny Ainge is out, is there something he would look for specifically that would really catch his eye over? Like, is there a certain factor that he would weigh more heavily than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think largely what you said is correct. And the big thing that any general manager who's intelligent would be looking for is to have a supportive and stable ownership situation. And I know very little about the, you know, I know it's been sort of a unfortunately handled topic recently by the aforementioned Bill Simmons in terms of national media. I don't pretend to know anything about the Pelicans ownership situation. But I think that's sort of the number one thing that any intelligent GM would go looking for, is an ownership group that is going to support a vision, and they're going to support it both financially and also in terms of like job security and media coverage and all that kind of thing. So that would be the big one. The problem with this thinking that Zarin might go to the Pelicans isn't that the Pelicans are necessarily a bad job. It's that, like, if you remember last offseason, there were people, really intelligent people, right? Like Zach Lowe and Howard Beck, I think, were talking about how, like, they thought there might be high-level GMs who were trying to force their way out of existing jobs to get that Sixers job. It was viewed as, like, an elite GM job, one of the jobs that, like, a job of the level that never comes onto the market. And that was only a year ago. It's not like that was 4 or 5 years ago where Zarin was mentioned for it and then apparently decided that he didn't want to pursue it. So if a job of that at least perceived caliber was out there that recently and he didn't go after it, it's a little bit hard to see him jumping ship to a situation that, even if you think it's a good situation, it wouldn't seem to be a situation quite that good. Now, there might be other things about it. Again, quality of life things. Maybe he's just had some life changes that he's made decisions about. Maybe it just wasn't the right time. Maybe he didn't want to go to a rival because he didn't want his dad to hate him. Who knows? But that's the one that is really challenging. It's not like he was turning down, you know, situations that seem like they have a high level of talent, but maybe a little bit less in terms of what you really, really want as a GM. It was that he turned down a, seemed to have turned down a position that looked like it was quite a good one.
So what you're saying is no one should really be holding their breath. And I think that's accurate. I think given the history and given everything that you've laid out, you know, Zarin obviously be a tremendous candidate, but perhaps the Pelicans should pursue more gettable people. And maybe David Griffin is that guy. And you know, he has ties to some of the Celtics front office. Like you mentioned, Dave Lewin, you said he worked as a cap guy in Cleveland. I think that was under David Griffin. So maybe, you know, we can end up with a Celtic one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly would be possible. I think Griffin's a really good GM as well. It's always difficult when you're judging guys basically on, like, one relatively short-term job and you don't have, like, a great view of their entire history. Because I'm a Celtics fan. Like, I don't follow every single position in the league. And that, particularly the LeBron kind of mess, is always going to be hard to judge somebody on. But he obviously seems to be a very credible candidate. I wouldn't be shocked if Zarin took the job because, again, I don't pretend to read his mind. But I would put Griffin, like, as a pretty substantial favorite over Zarin, at least, if those were the two that, you know, that they were most heavily trying to go after.
Now watch Carter and Justin come on and say the exact opposite.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't. I guess it's possible. But maybe they have some inside information that I don't. I haven't been to a game in a couple of months, so I haven't even said hi to Zarin in a while. So maybe a lot has changed in recent times.
Well, Ryan, I think, you know, I want to thank you for coming on. We've asked just about any questions we've wanted to ask. You know, if you have any for us, you know, feel free to give us a shout. But, like, we really appreciate the level of detail that you've gone into. And, you know, I hope your cold situation gets a little better. But, you know, before we sign off, where can people find you on Twitter? Where can they find your writing? Where can they go to read more things that you say and put out?
Nobody can find my writing anymore because I am retired as a writer. I write on a blog that barely exists. People can follow me on Twitter at DangerCart. It's spelled like it sounds, DangerCart. All one word if they really want to, or they can, I guess they can search for Ryan Bernardoni. I wouldn't suggest it if you're not a Celtics fan, unless, like, you are, I don't know, especially with the
nerd, you should
with the current situation
him.
Between the teams. Yeah, I mean, if you particularly have an interest in the salary cap, you could follow me, but unless you're, like, a glutton for punishment about Anthony Davis trade talk, maybe give it a couple of months before you follow me. But yeah, that's basically where you can get me. Anywhere else you would find it from there.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
From earaches to strep tests, there's MinuteClinic at CVS. See a provider, fill a prescription, and grab essentials. Or see us online with telehealth options. That's healthier made easier. Visit MinuteClinic at CVS today. Services vary by location. See MinuteClinic.com for details.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.